Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Sunday, September 14, 2014. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and we're coming to you tonight on a pre-recorded status and will be on a regular basis going forward. Changes at Progressive Radio Network necessitate our pre-recording the show, but airing it at the usual time on Sunday evenings. This means that because it is no longer a live show, we won't be taking callers. And we're very sorry about this because callers have been a very important aspect of this show since Mike Rupert created the Lifeboat Hour back in 2010. Nevertheless, the show must go on, as they say, and I, for one, am very grateful that we have the Lifeboat Hour, whether live or pre-recorded. Tonight we have with us a woman whose return to the show many of you have been waiting for. For several months, in fact, a woman who is a powerhouse of information and truth-telling. I'm talking about Mimi Gurman, who appeared on this show several times with Mike, and her reappearance tonight is momentous, since the last time she was on the Lifeboat Hour was when both she and I were Mike's guest on April 13 of this year, the night that Mike left us. On previous shows, Mimi has shared some very hard-hitting facts about the repercussions of the Fukushima nuclear tragedy in 2011 and has also spoken and written about the dangers of nuclear power worldwide. About herself, Mimi writes, "My last name is Gurman, pronounced with a hard G, not like the country, Germany. I'm not an expert in anything other than one who has to date figured out how to be standing still here on Earth. I am a human being and an Earth activist. I am a witness. I care about the Earth, my animals, my plants, and I care about those who get fucked by the system. I do not care so much for most people. I'm also an activist against humans breeding. I've been a no-nuker since I was 15 or 16. I am 50 years old now. My animals are my children and my little farm. My food is as and my little farm, my food as much as possible. I'm a straight shooter. I'm not diplomatic. At the same time, I can listen very well and change my views if someone shows me my views are wrong. But you would need a strong argument to do that. I created a radiation information site called Radcast, where I collect data and give it to the world for free for those who want it. It is a fact at this point that the governments around the world will not tell us what we are in store for regarding Fukushima and all other nuke plants waiting to explode or melt down. The government is now oil, nukes, pharmaceuticals, warlords, pimps, and drug dealers, self-serving oligarchical kings who would rather watch the poor die than lend a hand with money or food at any given point. War will always come first. I fight primarily for the closure of all nukes. Now I fight just to survive. Now I witness because there is not much time left. And yet, what a time it is." That's Mimi's introduction of herself, and you can find Radcast online at radcast.org. And welcome back to the show, Mimi.
Hi, it's so good to be back on the show.
I'd like to begin with a question about Fukushima, which you've covered so extensively at Radcast and on this show. What is your latest assessment of where the world is with Fukushima? The amount of radiation that has already been released, is being released every day, and what repercussions might we expect to see in the next 5 to 10 years?
You know, it would be great to be able to answer all of those questions. The one that I'm speaking about specifically is the one that would carry data with it. The data for me is one of the most interesting pieces of this whole puzzle with Fukushima, because it's the data that has been lied about from the beginning, as well as other things. But the data is what tells us just how bad Fukushima is. And, you know, with regard to that, the kind of futility in survival, the people of Japan specifically, are up against. So in the beginning, when the three nuclear power plants melted down, it happened quickly. And we weren't getting any data regarding measurements. The measurements are what tells us how bad it is. So we weren't getting any numbers as far as that went. And we found out now through groups like Informable and other groups in Canada who have collected FOIA documents, Freedom of Information Act documents, why we haven't received that data. And in part, again, the puzzle gets deeper, the rabbit hole gets deeper. Part of that lack of data that we have not received and are getting in dribs and drabs at this point is because, on one hand, TEPCO, who runs the nuclear power plant, who owns it, wasn't talking with the government, and the government wasn't talking with TEPCO. They're two completely separate entities. The joiner among both, I believe, between the government and TEPCO is the Yakuza, who is the Japanese mafia. And the Yakuza, as I talked about in different shows about Fukushima, the Yakuza is based all around nuclear power, whereas here the mafia is based on whatever they're based on in the United States. So the Yakuza are the money givers. So the Yakuza gives money to the politicians, which is the government, and the Yakuza gives the money to TEPCO. And when that happens and they become the joiner, they don't want the rest of the world to know what exactly has gone wrong, because it makes everybody look terrible. And nobody in Japan, the government or TEPCO, wants the nuclear power system to go down and be continued to in the shutoff process. So they don't want the data out. Well, we are receiving data. And the data that we're getting gets exponentially worse every time there's a release of data. The last numbers that we've seen, we're seeing radionuclides that are, tritium is one that's particularly terrible, and that's a continuum, and that's what's, it binds to water. And that water, which is going through the melt-throughs at the three power plants that melted down, is going directly into the ocean. So the ocean is getting tritiated. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. It's not stoppable. If it is stoppable, nobody's quite figured out how to do this yet in a way that will work. So all of the animals in the ocean are getting radionuclides. They're eating it. It goes into the plant life, and it works its way up the food chain. And then, of course, people eat that. And then as it evaporates, it also goes back into the air. So it's a terrible system. The cesium, the amounts of cesium are in the billions, as is the tritium. Billions of becquerels, that is the measurement term, becquerel. And it's difficult to imagine how high a number this is, what this means. And I just equate it to death, because it's a death number. If you receive these amounts of radionuclides, whether it's in your food or you're breathing it into your body, depending on how it's coming to you, it is the equivalent of a death sentence for you. So that's how bad it is. And it's a 24/7 problem. It's never going to stop. I mean, I can't see how this is going to stop. So if you don't know where the core is of three cores are on the loose, if you can't find them and you can't get to them due to the amount of heat that they're putting out, and you can't stop them, and they're in the water supply, not just the ocean, but the water supply, so people are ingesting this, how are you going to stop this? It's just a monster on the loose. So that's kind of what we're dealing with.
Okay, I think it's probably very difficult for most people, including myself, to even wrap their minds around this. And so why do you think that the worst nuclear accident in the history of nuclear energy on this planet was never fully investigated by the United Nations or any other world body to assess how catastrophic it was and is?
Well, that kind of comes back for me to the fact that any government that I believe that government, no matter where it is corrupt in some way. I have yet to meet a government that is not. So when you have a government that puts into an oversight facility its own people, so the NRC in our case in the United States, the NRC is an oversight group that's supposed to be oversight for nuclear power plants to make sure that they're safe. But the government, which isn't safe or legitimate in many ways, is the one that's created the NRC. So the NRC is an offshoot of bad fruit. So the bad fruit is overlooking more bad fruit, which is the nuclear power industry. The nuclear power industry pays off the NRC. The NRC continues to get money from the DOE. Again, all of these are offshoots from the overall umbrella, which is government, to do all of, you know, it is that the old story of, you know, who's watching the chickens. And in this case, with the energy source that can end the entire life on the planet, when it's run by a corrupt organization or five, there's no telling what can happen, except again, back to the destruction of the planet. And that's where we're headed. And we're headed that way from the nuclear power industry. And sure, we're headed that way from the oil industries too, but the nuclear power industry has the capability of ending all life on the planet, which is what we're seeing at Fukushima.
So I'm sure this directly relates to the Environmental Protection Agency as well and its role in nuclear issues. And so, you know, those nuclear issues obviously are as horrifying in the United States as they are anywhere else. And you point out repeatedly that the so-called regulatory agencies aren't doing anything except, as you say, the mimicking the fox watching the chicken house. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on the EPA specifically.
Well, one of the things that we found out from the EPA is, and the EPA said this, we actually have this in print from them. When Fukushima happened, we had monitors around the United States, and they monitor radiation readings. And we know that right after Fukushima happened, the West Coast radiation monitoring system was shut down by the EPA. So what are we left to think? Here's the EPA whose job it is to monitor radiation, and it is solely their job to monitor radiation. I found this out through a whole chain of events, who is in charge of this. And it is the EPA's job. Well, the EPA is the group that told us that they shut it down. Why would we need to continue to have things monitored? Everything seemed fine. And what we know now that we had those dribs and drabs of facts put out regarding data was that things weren't fine. We were having radiation fallout in the United States on the West Coast pretty much immediately after, you know, within a few days of Japan's meltdowns. So the EPA is, in my mind, the leaders of the EPA at that time should be in jail for murder, because what we're seeing now is a rise in illness among children with thyroid cancer on the West Coast. And this is going to get worse and worse over time, not just because of the initial shock and fallout that happened on 3/11, but continuously because Fukushima has never ended. There's a constant supply of radiation going out. Now, it won't necessarily be more and more and more thyroid, like new thyroid cases, I believe it will be, because we're not necessarily getting, you know, iodine rained on us at this point. That's something that happens in the beginning. But we are receiving fallout with other radionuclides in them, which do cause cancer. Cesium will come into the tissue in the body, and it will affect heart disease and major heart attacks. The strontium that is very difficult to find in testing comes in through our shellfish, it comes in with perhaps fallout, and that goes into our bones, and it acts like it's like a calcium mimicker, And so we'll be seeing a rise in bone cancers, all kinds of things. And this will happen. This is happening now, but it's going to get worse because it takes a while for all of those cancers to become. And this is all, part of it is all in collusion with the EPA, the NRC, the DOE here, and with our role in not preventing an international team of scientists to go into Fukushima in the beginning and tell TEPCO, who was refusing to have an international team come in, to say, you don't get to choose. You know, you've already shown immediately that you can't handle this, so we're going to come in. So, again, the EPA, the NRC, and the DOE are all, in my mind, worthy of major jail time, prison, for helping our United States citizens to acquire deadly disease and not tell us about it, not protect us from it, and leave us in the dark.
And very related to this, Mimi, on the RadCast website, you have linked several papers by Dr. Timothy Musso. Please tell us who he is and why you value his work so much.
We don't have a lot of people able to get into these very contaminated sites to do the research that needs to be done regarding radiation and what that does to the biology of the planet. So Dr. Musso is a professor of biology sciences, and he works at the University of South Carolina. I pulled a couple of things from his site to just read to people so that they understand who he is. He deals with the ecological and evolutionary consequences of radioactive contaminants affecting populations of birds, animals, and people in areas around Chernobyl and Fukushima. What that means is, what happens to bird life? What happens to insect life? What happens to every plant life? And how does all of this, we know that everything affects everything, so how does radiation come in and play a role in increasing mutations and creating a load of dysfunctional DNA or a changed DNA? And what does that difference in DNA do to what we know as life on this planet? So he's one of the few people on his team who are able to go in and let us know what he sees. And what he sees is what those of us who follow these kinds of things would expect. And he's seeing dramatic consequences for survival development. He's seeing changes in reproduction. And mostly that there's a large biological impact on the communities of everything around us, the air we breathe, the plant life that, you know, helps an insect form, which then helps a larger mammal, you know, eat that, and so on and so on. So we're changing everything that we know, everything that's taken billions of years to become. We're changing it in a moment through the hubris of nuclear power. And, you know, I wish that the geniuses, I use the word loosely or hesitatingly, you know, that the Einsteins that were around in the days that these thoughts were becoming, I wish they were here today to talk to people, to say, while we knew that these were, you know, we needed to learn how to split an atom, let's just say, what would they say today? I'd love to hear what Einstein would say today with what he sees happening. And maybe that would have made a difference. I don't know, but I don't think so. I think hubris is bigger than all of that. And that's what we see. And that's why the EPA has no oversight over itself. And hubris is why the NRC has no oversight over itself. And that's why the nuclear power industry has no oversight over itself. And that's why our government has no oversight. We don't even have checks and balances anymore. We have a government that can do whatever it wants according to the Supreme Court. We have no say anymore. And this is what they've all chosen to do. The choice that's been made has been to kill the planet. And their choice in their minds might be, well, of course we're not choosing to kill the planet, we're choosing to make money. That equals killing the planet, because that's the path that they've carved out. So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, we have this huge climate march coming up on the 21st, and my feeling about the climate march, when I think about all of the things that are happening now, to the degree that they're happening, and that nuclear power wasn't even a consideration in the climate march, I know that we will be represented there, but the fact that people don't understand the degree to which we have already killed the planet, the degree to which we have created death that we've yet to see among us from nuclear power, not just in Japan, but in the United States, in France. Germany is one of the few places that has its head on, right, that said no to nuclear power after Fukushima happened. So I'm at a place now where knowing the degree to which we have decimated life on the planet, I'm just going to witness it getting worse and worse and live the best I can, you know, with my animals, with the food I grow, and, you know, try to find happiness on a daily basis. It's hard to do when you know what our governments around the world, what our governments have done.
Well, you know, right about now we need a song, and the song we're going to play is your song. Would you tell us a little bit about your song?
Oh, yeah. Some of the songs that I used to write, I'm not writing anymore at the moment, but the songs that I used to write were primarily about the environment. And, boy, I don't even remember what song I gave you, but...
I believe it's More Than I.
More Than I. Okay. So More Than I was a song that I wrote looking out at my garden. And I was looking out as we were creating the music and recognizing that all of the beauty that I see and how it got here and the time that it took to get here, you know, that we can see a tree, its glory, and the hummingbirds in the garden enjoying the flowers that we plant and the squirrels being happy and, you know, all of that, the blue skies that some of us can still see, you know. It's just more than I could ever, ever imagine happening. And it's so beautiful and it's such a gift. And all I was doing was looking into the garden and writing the lyrics that you're about to hear. But that's what it's about. It's about the supreme beauty of our planet. And I'm so saddened that, you know, somehow we have allowed and we have voted in governments, again, around the world, because in any democratic area of the world, people voted in the government that exists. And we voted in killers. We voted in people who have no, what would seem to be, have no heart, have no soul, have no connection to the planet that we live on. And I can't work with that. I can't handle that concept. So I just would rather spend time being in the garden. So I hope you enjoy the song.
So here it is, More Than I, written by Mimi Gurman.
Yeah.
We're back with you on the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and we're talking with Mimi Gurman of radcast.org about Fukushima, nuclear radiation contamination worldwide, and her work with Radcast. And, you know, the song is just, and as you described it and the writing of it, Mimi, just really takes me to, you know, what I'm constantly writing and speaking about, which is art, music, dance, expression, and the sharing of that expression to bring meaning and purpose to us and comfort amid this madness. Mimi, how can people get in touch with you?
You can all write to me if you have questions or you just want to get in touch at info@radcast.org. You know, Carolyn, I wanted to thank you for the work that you do, because so much of what you do is to help us have ideas in how to handle the devastation and destruction that we're all living through at the moment, you know, at this time on the planet. And for those of us who do this kind of work, whether it's people stopping fracking sites or coal trains or oil trains or the tar sands or nukes, you know, we all have gotten to a point where we don't know how we're going to get up the next day, because it is as if we know too much. When you know that your planet is in peril and there's nowhere else to go after here, and you care about the plant life and you care about the animals, and for those of you with children, you care about your children or the children who are the innocents around the globe, it's just hard to handle, you know. And there, I'm grateful to you and the guests that you've had on this show who really do bring us helpful ways to cope with all this. Because, as we know, there are many of us in our movements who can't handle it, and we do need to help and reach out to each other and protect each other so that we don't get to a day when we can no longer handle it and we decide to take our own lives. We have to be here for each other, and I feel that from you, and I thank you.
Well, thank you so much for that, and I really do bow to your work. And you know, we've been talking so much here about the world, and I'd like to bring it a little closer to home now, because here in the U.S. we have two infamous nuclear sites that it seems more than any others are posing lethal threats to all living beings in this country and beyond. Those are Hanford Nuclear Plant in Washington State and the WIPP site in New Mexico. I'd like you to talk about both places and give us a brief history of their existence and the threats they pose.
Sure. The Hanford Nuclear Waste Site is, just for people to know, there are no nuclear plants that are part of Hanford on that site anymore. It's a waste site, and it's the largest waste site in the Northern Hemisphere, and it is leaking terribly. There were originally 177 sometimes million gallon tanks underground. It's called the tank farm. And those tanks, many of them are already leaking. And those that aren't leaking will be leaking because they're all made of the same material. The metals are all the same. So it's just a matter of time. We have at Hanford a plume from the leaking waste at the tank farm that is in the river, the Columbia River, which goes from Canada to the Pacific. So we do have one plume that is in the river now. There's a secondary plume from the tank farm that is going towards the river that has not been able to have been stopped yet. So that's coming. And what that will do is make the Columbia River uninhabitable if that secondary plume gets there. And even now, Dr. Helen Caldicott and I had a long conversation about society living along the river from Hanford down. And she feels very strongly that we shouldn't be here at all now and shouldn't have been here for the decades that, you know, that plume had reached the river. So I just wanted to put that out, that the people in the Northwest we're all risking our lives by being here due to Hanford. Along with Hanford, I have to tell people that there is a nuclear power plant 10 miles on the same reservation. It's the Hanford Reservation, called the Columbia Generating Station. And that is one of the worst nuclear power plants in the United States, made almost identically to the power plants that were created in Fukushima that melted down. If we have an accident, let's say the grid goes down, which is highly likely for many reasons. A squirrel could make, you know, a squirrel on a wire could actually make the grid go down. If things went to the worst degree and the grid went down, the Columbia Generating Station has a high likelihood of melting down as well. If we have the big earthquake that the University of Washington geological team told us we are waiting for, it's overdue. If we get that earthquake, or when we get that earthquake, there's a high likelihood that now that we know there are many, many fault lines underneath CGS, as we call it, CGS will also fail. If CGS fails, if it explodes or melts down or has some kind of, you know, catastrophic event, Hanford and the 56 million gallons of highly radioactive waste, which is contained or not really contained at the tank farm, will all let loose. This will be devastation for the United States. Okay, so that's that. WIP is in New Mexico and near Carlsbad. And WIP on February 14th had a drum, like a 50-gallon drum, explode. And in that drum was radioactive waste. And the ventilation system that was supposed to put in filtration, should something like this occur, so that the waste, the radiation flow was kept down half a mile deep in these salt caverns, which is what WIP is, those didn't work. So we had a direct hit into the atmosphere of radioactive waste. And the primary radionuclides were americium and plutonium. They went directly into the air. This is an area with civilization. This is an area where there are cities, not large cities, but cities. And then we have the direction of the wind at the time, which was heading towards Texas. So, again, similar to Fukushima when that happened, we weren't receiving data on measurements. How much americium and plutonium went out? What did the societies near that area get hit with? What did they breathe in? Well, my lab partner, Mark, and I yesterday found from the New Mexico University test results that were able to at least answer some of our questions. And what we found out was that the level of americium that went directly into the air, again, americium is from plutonium, that went directly into the air was, this is a measurement, it was 500,000 becquerels of americium went into the air. Well, we don't know much more than that regarding that particular test. That's a very, very, very high number. And what that means is the plutonium and americium that went out affected the entire biology of that region and anywhere the winds blew. So now we wait and we follow up by seeing who gets sick. And this is the game. This is what happens. These areas that were created, again, through the the men decades ago in the 30s who wanted to do this and create nuclear bombs, they created the monster, and the monster got out immediately. We're still dealing with it. So people don't understand that WIP, at this point in the United States, is probably the worst nuclear release that we've had. We think about Three Mile Island. This is worse. And this hasn't stopped. So there is a drum of americium and plutonium down below, half a mile deep, that's still leaking. And is it contained? Is the ventilation system working? Even if that ventilation system were working 99% of the time, we'd still be getting, on that 1% of the time, radiation into the atmosphere. So we're back again, Carolyn, to what have these people done to us? How many people have they killed? How many people are going to die? How many babies aren't going to be born because during in vitro, their DNA is so affected that they can't even come to term? And how many babies will be born with birth defects from WIP? Well, we're going to find out. This is one of the things that, you know, people who study this are going to have to start to study. It's going to be scary.
We're talking with Mimi Gurman from radcast.org. That's radcast.org. And I really encourage you to go to that site. It's a treasure trove of information and documentation. And Mimi, just last week, nuclear activist Harvey Wasserman, in the aftermath of the Napa, California earthquake, has written about the dangers posed by the San Onofre and Diablo Canyon nuclear power plants in California in relation to earthquakes. Can you say more about this?
Sure. We up here are dealing with similar issues with the earthquake. I touched on it earlier.
Right.
Diablo Canyon is basically sitting in the ocean, and it's on a ridge. I mean, it's right there at the ocean. It's surprising that Diablo Canyon is still there, due to the amount of earthquakes that California does get hit with. And because California does experience so many earthquakes, it makes Diablo Canyon that much more vulnerable to complete devastation. So what Harvey is trying to do is get people to understand that Diablo Canyon needs to be shut down and closed forever, you know. So he's working really hard at putting that information out along with other groups, other anti-nuke groups in California. We now have somebody who works at the NRC who came out as a whistleblower to say that this is true, that Diablo Canyon does need to get shut down. This is a first. We never have whistleblowers who are still working at the NRC able to say anything against what the NRC normally does, which is keep anything dealing with nuclear power open. So it's a great thing that we now have an insider who is coming out saying this needs to be shut down. Well, we'll see what happens. The push is on. There are lots of things on social media circulating for people to sign, petitions to sign. If you happen to see those petitions, please sign them. You don't need to live in California to have this affect you. So along with that, I wrote to the group, the large group that is part of San Onofre and Diablo Canyon, just the other day, and I said, you know, I think that it would be a stunning feat of coming together if your two groups, and this isn't to Harvey, Harvey's there to help, but the two groups that really exist with San Onofre and Diablo, if your two groups will allow CGS, the Columbia Generating Station, which will also be affected by an earthquake, to come together to say that for the remaining nuclear power plants on the West Coast, we want them all shut down. And we come together as a West Coast force to the NRC and to the people of the United States, saying, wouldn't you like to know that the two nuclear power plants that are still working on the West Coast are shut down, since they can both be affected quick? So we'll see what happens there, too. This is kind of a wait-and-see game, but the push is on. And Harvey is amazing. He is a force. He is eloquent. And I'm glad we have him. But that's what's going on. If there's an earthquake and it pushes the earth underneath Diablo Canyon and anything shifts over there, anything can break. And we're dealing with cooling systems. We're dealing with plumbing. We deal with electricity. Anything can go wrong. And if one thing can go wrong, no matter how small, it can cause an event that can make a release happen, and we don't want that to happen. You know, it can be as bad as Fukushima, and it can be right here. And then what we would have is Fukushima hitting the Pacific from their coast, and we would have Diablo Canyon hitting the ocean from our coast. We'd have nothing left in the ocean, and right now it's debatable as to what is left and how long what is left has you know, time-wise, to remain.
And this brings me to the next question, which is totally related. You've talked about the nuclear issues being so severe worldwide that they could possibly override the methane releases that are pushing us toward near-term human extinction. I'd like to hear you say more about that.
Yeah, this is also a case of what's going to happen first, which is going to take over first and cause the greatest amount of unlivability. So we know from Guy's work and other people's work, the amount of methane release is enormous. And, it's heating up the planet. What we also know in the nuclear world is that just about every nuclear power plant out there, give or take a few, are beyond their design time. Nuclear power plants have a lifespan. And the lifespan is, let's say the lifespan is 40 years. They're all basically above that time. And the reason that they're given a lifespan is when you are moving this kind of heat in and among the cooling pools, the plumbing, the electrical, and everything that can go wrong, you can't extend the lifetime of that concrete, of that plant. It has to stop. So if you are a 40-year-old nuclear power plant, you should not ever be relicensed. You should just be, you know, on shutdown and let the people take care of what's in it, let them move what they can, you know, into at least safer storage for the time being until it has to be moved again into safer storage, because there is no such thing as safe storage. And so on. But what the NRC does is they have, it's like an unspoken rule. If there is a nuclear power plant that comes up for relicensing, even if it's an early relicensing, in other words, the design time hasn't even been reached yet, and this is the case with the Columbia Generating Station. The Columbia Generating Station went to the NRC and said, we want to have you relicense CGS early so that when it comes time for us to apply for licensing, for relicensing, it will already have been done. And what that means is you won't have to come back in 10 years or 7 years when it expires. You will already have relicensed it, and we can pretend everything is fine. Well, the NRC has an unspoken rule that anyone who applies for relicensing of a nuclear power plant can have its relicensing. There's no discussion. There's no public meetings. They just stamp the approval. And imagine, we have 99 working nuclear power plants in the United States. And even if they're not, even if they haven't reached their design time yet, they're still in major degrade mode from early on due to, you know, what it's carrying through it. And each of these has been relicensed. There's no oversight. Any of these power plants can go down. And going down in a nuclear power plant can mean meltdown. It can mean hydrogen explosion. Whatever it is really bad. It's a killing machine. People will die. When we had floods in the Midwest 2 years ago, we had a nuclear power plant flood in the Midwest. I can't remember which one it was, if it was Fort Calhoun. I really can't remember offhand, but it's Googleable, and it flooded. And the flood started to do damage to the plant, and the plant had to go on to, I don't know if it had to go into like automatic shutdown, SCRAM is what it's called, but this can happen anywhere. Look at the weather changes that we see on a daily basis anywhere around the world. We have nuke plants around the world. You know, India has nuke plants. All of Europe has nuke plants, again, except Germany, as they work on shutting theirs down. And Japan still has nuke plants. Korea, everywhere. If any of these go, we have more Fukushimas everywhere. And any of these, including Fukushima at the top of the list, has the capability of continuing to wipe us off this planet and kill everything, as Dr. Musso has shown us. So we're really in a bind here, and it's a race not for survival. We are in a race to kill ourselves. And that is, it's sociopathic, it's genocidal, it's so many things that I feel, Carolyn, that you are the one who is able to talk about that, what it is.
Well, yes, and you are the one who has this wonderful perspective of the con. And, you know, we can't really talk intelligently about any of this if we don't understand the origin of the lethal, absurd paradigm that has created the current catastrophe. So I'd like you to talk to us about what you call the con, which puts all of this in context.
You know, I was thinking for a long time this year, I was actually talking with Michael Rupert about this quite a bit, that at one point long ago, when we switched over in eras to the Holocene era, we were able to, as the weather changed and we were able to start to grow food, we were able to create more of us. You know, and I'm going to try to make this, I'm sort of summarizing how I see the con and what happened. At one point, we were hunters and gatherers. And to me, that was socialism. To me, that was, it's perfect. You know, you had people going out to make sure the food came home, and you had people making sure there was a home for the food to come to. And I'm not talking in a sexist way. I don't care who did it, you know.
Right.
The fact was that people needed to eat, and people needed to be warm, and people needed to have a place to sleep. And that seemed to work until the earth changed. Then the earth changed, and what happened was we were able to leave that fire and create fires elsewhere. That's sort of how I look at it. And instead of having one general fire, we had many. So the fires, the people around the fires, the community broke down. And the community became smaller and smaller and smaller. When we have community, we have a working relationship with what needs to get done. And the key word there is what needs to get done. So we had people who had different talents in a community who were able to do this, that, and the other thing to make everything happen. And it did. And as people left the larger community for smaller communities and then smaller communities and smaller communities, we eventually had what we call small little families. And those families only took care of themselves. And more and more of this, you know, continued to happen. You know, people had more babies, and instead of caring about what was happening over the next hill, you know, and what they needed, you were only concerned now about what your immediate family needed. And this, I believe, was the start of the destruction. What happened from that point to me, the way I look at it, is as we looked at what we needed and left the community and left concept of the whole for the individual, we started to also create want and desire. And that was never needed before. You just had what you needed. And when want became something that it perpetuated itself, well, I'm going to go and get that because I think that that would be pretty neat over here in my little family. You know, well, I want more of that. So want started to happen because the world was able to provide it. The earth was able to provide it. The weather was able to provide you with more. So more and want became a greater something to strive for. And over time, we created the corporation. And again, this is a summary of how I view the con. So we create, we want, let's say, I want more of those fruit trees. So somebody else sees, oh, that family wants more fruit trees. Well, maybe what I'll do is I'll create a grove of fruit trees. And then they can come to me and get the fruit from the fruit trees that I grow, because then they don't have to grow them. And then that person says, well, maybe I should be paid in some way for the fruit that I'm giving them. And on, so that want and more started to become what was the fabric of how we lived over need. And we created, people created the corporations that we now abhor. And we can pretend that the oil corporation is not what we want while we get into our cars and drive. We can pretend that the nuclear corporation isn't what we want when we turn on our lights. And we can pretend that they all exist over there, that they are the evildoers over there. And we move farther and farther away from the memory of the fact that we created this. And if we're going to take responsibility and we're going to create a change, it's not going to happen from marching in the street. It's going to happen from turning your lights off. It's going to happen from moving away from needing anything that you created that gives you the grid that you live on. So if you really want change, and you're going to get real about the change that you say you really want, you have to give up the corporation that you created in the first place out of your want and your need. So that's where I'm at with it. And, you know, if you don't grow your food, but you go out on the street and you bitch about Monsanto, I look at you and say, wow, you really don't get it. Are you growing your own food? And you say, no. Well, I don't have a place big enough. Okay, you can get a bucket and grow your own food. You just need some soil, you know? And so I guess I call people out on that. I call myself out on that. And I look at how I live. I haven't given up my car. So I'm a part of that oil industry that I detest, but I recognize that I created it. So I look at everything that we've done. I look at this planet that we will kill, at least as we know it, for the kind of survival that would host us and our animals and the birds that we see. Who knows what's going to happen, you know, millions of years from now. I sure don't. But I know it's not going to host us much longer. So I look at it all and I go, wow, I did this. And I don't look at it and say, you did this. You look at yourself. And you decide how much of a part of this you were. And get real about it, because what else do you have to do now except wait this out and try to be happy and love the ones you're with? Look at yourself and get real. And maybe as we go down, you know, this terrible path together, maybe if we can be real about it, we can come together in a way that is even more loving and more understanding, and we can help each other for the final, you know, the final path out. Because the rest of it's just a lie. It is a lie to go march in the street when you drive your car. It's a lie to go march in the street about the chemicals on your food when you buy those foods, you know. And you don't grow your own food, and you don't save your own seeds, and you don't take part in teaching children how to do all of these things that we need to do to continue to survive for as long as that term survival is here for us to understand. And in understanding the term survival, you have to understand that there's an endpoint if we're going to continue the way that we continue. I actually believe that we're beyond that. The end point does exist. We just don't know what day.
I so much appreciate and value your words and that really beautiful, articulate explanation that you just gave us about the con that just puts so much in perspective. And I'd like you to give us a full description of Radcast. Talk about when it began, how it began, or how it's, when it began and what it's done is what I mean to say, and what it's doing now.
There was a time about 2 years ago, I've been a part of a radiation reading group that's actually international. And I realized one day that people should know what kind of radiation we're dealing with, but it's invisible, and you have to learn a whole different language. It's not a big language, but it's a different language in order to understand what is out in the air among us and in the soil and in the waters among us that can hurt us. And once you learn that language, you know what these numbers mean. So you can decide and you can make decisions for yourself. And I want my animals to play in the rain today. Maybe the rain is too hot, you know, with radiation. Or maybe, oh, it's a good day. The radiation's down. I'm going to run outside. Well, then I thought, well, nobody knows this stuff. So why don't we create something called Radcast, where the radiation readings can get put out to the world, just like a weather report. If you know that, you know, your city is going to be 80 degrees or it's going to be 2 Celsius, however you talk about it. The same thing with radiation, that there should be readings on the news. There should be readings on the radio. There should be readings everywhere to let you know how you're being affected by what you can't see. So that's how it began. And then in the process, we thought, well, why don't we have some information on what's going on in the United States around nuclear power? And why don't we have some information on what, for instance, Dr. Timothy Mousseau is up to, so that people can understand how radiation is affecting the biology around you, and so on. And so we've put as much as we can for the moment as a very, very tiny group of people. There's 3 of us, primarily with Radcast, and it's Mark Casebeer is he's part of the lab, and myself, and Shoshana is she helps out with the website. And so there's not a whole lot that we can do, but we teach people about Geiger counters and anything really dealing with radiation in a way that you, the people, can understand. This is meant for you. This is not meant for scientists. They have their own labs, and they have their own belief systems. We are a very political, or I should say environmental, organization, and we believe that nuclear power should be stopped. So there's no discrepancy there. You know, we are definite. We have an opinion. And that's basically what Radcast is. And if anybody wants to take part in Radcast, you can. If you want to see something on Radcast that you aren't seeing, let me know. And maybe you can help me put it on the website, because this is all volunteer. And by the way, if you want to donate, you can do that. There's a donate button on the site.
And you can contact Mimi at info@radcast.org. And then the last question I want to ask you, and we've only got about 3 minutes, Mimi, what are some of the things that our listeners can do in relation to the nuclear catastrophe that surrounds us?
The first thing that I ask people to do is learn what nuclear power plant is near you and start to talk to your friends about it. Find out through the NRC site. They have an event page, and that tells you everything that's wrong with that nuclear power plant on a daily basis. Learn how endangered you are because of your nuclear power plant, and get your community to start to understand how you can shut that power plant down. This is very difficult to do. Without trying, we are left with, you know, where we were yesterday. So that's the first thing. On Radcast, we do have different areas that talk about nutrition and ways to boost your immune system, essential oils that can help you. So all kinds of things like that, foods that are worthy of eating, again, that can help cellular structure. So these things are powerful. They enable you to live in a biology, in an environment that is becoming more and more on a daily basis unsuitable for us. And remember that the term sustainable at this point has a whole different meaning from what you used to think it meant. Sustainable now means sustaining us until we can no longer sustain the inhospitable world that nuclear power has created for us.
I want to thank you so much, Mimi Gurman, for being with us. You can contact Mimi at radcast.org. I encourage people to go there, inform yourselves. The site is just a virtual encyclopedia of all things nuclear that we need to inform ourselves about. And so my hat's off to you, Mimi. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you all for listening to the Lifeboat Hour. Please join us again next week. And have a good one. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn.
You're welcome.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows.